Now, Christian Whakapapa. So there's a bit of a history lesson this morning. And I want to start by quoting from Thomas Cahill. He's written a number of historical books, only about 200 pages. I think there's eight in the series. I've read two of them. The first one was How the Irish Saved Civilization. And the second one, the second one was How the Gift of the Jews to the World. And in that book, and almost summarising the book, there is this quote, and we'll come back to it on a... it's already up. Well, that's not the quote, but... So Thomas says, the Jews gave us the outside and the inside. Our outlook and our inner life. We can hardly get up in the morning or cross the street without being Jewish. Most of our best words, new, adventure, surprise, unique, individual, person, vocation, time, history, future, freedom, progress, spirit, faith, hope, justice are the gifts of the Jews. So that needs some explanation, and so I'll try and do that in a very brief time. You need to read the book. Abraham, that's where we start with our Whakapapa. An individual, a speck in the world, unknown, doing his business, going about his family life, in Ur of the Chaldees, they call it back there. You can see Ur down there on the bottom right-hand corner, right at the base in the delta of the Tigris-Euphrates River. Ur was a fairly important city in the Sumerian world, and it really should be called Sumerian because Chaldees and Chaldeans didn't happen for another 1,000 years. So why it mentions Ur of the Chaldees, I'm not sure. And in this city, there was a moon god. It was the most important god of the Sumerians. And the moon god's name was Nana Sin, which I thought was great for a grandmother. And amongst the pantheon of gods was all of the gods of the Sumerian world. But Nana Sin, the moon god, was the most important. And so Abraham was a polytheist, believed in many gods, as pretty well everybody in the known world then, before and afterwards, believed. And these gods were terribly important because you wouldn't do anything without God's blessing. And so there was a great deal of rigmarole regarding how to access these gods and find out what the gods wanted and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, it was a lot, it was all to do with astronomy and astrology. And the ancient world from way, way back had this fascination for the heavens. And from the heavens, they gained everything, they hoped to gain everything that they ever wanted in terms of finding out what these heavenly gods were all about. And so, in the midst of all of this, Abraham and his father, and he was just a son, moved on up the Fertile Crescent to Haran, or Haran, in the little red blob up there, and they resettled. No one knows why they resettled, but they did. Why they left Ur, but they did. So that's the story of the Bible that we have. And it was at Ur that this no person, individual being called Abram then, or Avram as the Hebrews called him, got some kind of communication from a god. And the god said to Abram, leave your country, your family, and your father's home for a land that I will show you. And I'll make you a great nation and bless you. And I'll make you famous. And you'll be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you, and those who curse you, I'll curse. All the families of the earth will be blessed through you. So Abram just left as God said, and Lot left with him. Abram was 75 years old when he left Haran. Now we can't appreciate what that meant. I don't think so. Because that meant that suddenly, out of this pantheon of gods, a god singled out a man and said, do something which has never been done before. Now, that didn't mean to say that people didn't move around, but they didn't move around at the instruction of a god. Because this pantheon of gods, this heavenly pantheon, is all based on the system of the heavens. And my wife was out early this morning to look at the comets that are flying into space and the lineup of the planets that happened this week. Now, we know exactly, almost to the minute, when that's going to happen. So precise is the definition of the work of the planets and the heavenly spheres. And the people of Sumeria and many, most other nations trusted in this. Trusted in it so much that they called it the wheel of life. So the sun comes up and the sun goes down, and the moon comes up and the moon goes down, and spring and summer and autumn and winter always follow. And things happen in a precise way every year and never changes. And suddenly, out of nowhere, a little man, unknown, unthought of, unseen really by anybody but his family, gets a message saying, I want to change all of that for you. I want you to go where you've never been before. I want you to do what you've never done before. I want you to be what you've never been before. Now, that was unprecedented and unheard of. No one would dare to go out on a limb and do something different in the Sumerian world, because the gods wouldn't let it. The gods were precise, never changed. You knew exactly what they were going to do, but not for Abram. And so we come to this quote, you see. This quote of Thomas Cahill, which summarizes his book. Ponder. Go back. Daniel, let me do it. Ponder the quote. That's what we have inherited. None of those words, in terms of Thomas Cahill's opinion, would have been possible without the call of Abraham. Without the breaking of the wheel and the breaking of the system to go out on an adventure. Surprise. Individual. etc. That's the first ponder of the rock from which we have been hewn. That is why we can be adventurous, why we can be individualistic, surprising, etc., etc., all of those words. That is our heritage. All right, we move on to Moses, as Daniel has already shown you. In Exodus 3, Moses said to God, "Suppose I go to the people of Israel and I tell them, 'The God of your fathers sent me to you.' And they ask me, 'Well, okay, what's his name?' What do I tell them?" You see, every god had a name. Egypt had thousands of gods, and everyone had a name. Samaria had thousands, and everyone had a name. So now, again, out of the blue, like Abraham, Moses gets this epiphany, this call, out in the desert, single man, individual, suddenly, the bush bursts into flame, suddenly, there is an encounter. "Go back and let my people go and get them out of there." Well, it was a bit of a call, you might say. I mean, Egypt was one of the most powerful nations in the world of its day, if not the most powerful. And so he had every right to say, okay, what do I tell them? What God am I coming to the Egyptian pantheon with? And so we have this extraordinary and fascinating historical statement here. God said to Moses, "I am who I am. Tell the people of Israel, I am sent me to you." God continued speaking to Moses, reassuring him. Well, I don't know whether there was much reassurance, but "I am God. I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as the strong God, El Shaddai. But my name, God, I am, I was not known to them." Now, it's a name but not a name, because as I've said before here from the pulpit, it's a verb. It's not a noun. And so God presents to Abraham this unusual description of a name of his being. And this is extraordinary again. It's extraordinary news to Moses, who was brought up as an Egyptian. And he knew the gods of Egypt. And some of them I've put up there. Don't need to worry about the names of them. But the thing that I get from this is that here we are called to an unprecedented relationship. Here we have God again singling out a person and wanting a relationship with him. Because when you share names, you're sharing relationship. God comes to this individual in the desert who was minding his own business with the flocks, and he says, basically, "I want a relationship with you. But this is going to entail something that you've never would have imagined in your life. You're going to go back, and you're going to face a god. The god of all gods in Egypt was the Pharaoh. And you're going to face him with this request, command. And it's going to happen in my name." Now, Moses definitely showed that fate was not his mode of operation after he met Yahweh. Daniel, you're doing well, so move on to the next one. What have we got here? All right, next one. One to one. Next one. I call this encounter, I call Yahweh the kaleidoscope God, because God, the Yahweh God of Moses, and you can go to the next one, Daniel, can do anything. He is a God that you cannot fit into a box. Every God was fitted into a box. Every God had a work to do. But here we find an encounter where God is unprecedented kaleidoscope. He can do whatever he wants to do. And he does. And so Isaiah says later, and many of the prophets echo the same sentiment. So to whom will you compare me? And there were plenty of gods to compare him with. And it would be good at this point to read, to go home and read some of the chapters in Isaiah, starting from about 40 to 46, and just see how Isaiah handles this idea of Yahweh and the gods. He's an extraordinary writer, is Isaiah, and he deals with it in an extraordinary way. But of course, we know so much of that. So this is our inheritance. This is through Moses. Then we go on. We jump quite a lot into the New Testament. And we are faced with a verse right at the beginning of the Gospels. Well, in terms of John anyway. In the beginning, the Word already existed. And the Word was with God. And the Word was God. Now, this Greek word logos is used about 300 times in the New Testament, not associated with Jesus at all, but it's a common word. It was a common Greek word, generally talking about communication. Speaking, preaching is an act of logos. Or logoi, I suppose, in the plural. And so we have another encounter. God came to Abraham. God came to Moses. God comes to Israel. The Logos, the Word. And so we are faced with further inheritance. This word, this logos, this concept of communication becomes concrete in a person. So what God was saying was, I got something to say to you. I've said something to Abraham. I've said something to Moses. Now I've got something to say to you. You're not going to hear it except through the lips of a man. His name's Jesus. They call him the Anointed One, the Christ, but his name is Jesus. That's all you need to know. But you need to know this, John says, that he came to us and he lived among us. And John further says, he that has seen me has seen the Father. There is no discontinuity here. There is, here am I, and there you see God, Father. When I speak as a father. When I work, I do what the Father tells me to do. I work his work. There is no discontinuity. We are one. Now, you can do one of two things with that. You can say that's a lot of nonsense, or you have to believe it. You have to believe that this man who walked in Palestine, and there is some historical evidence that that was true, that he represented God and was God in flesh. Now, that is our inheritance. You might stumble over it. I have stumbled over it. I think, how could that be possible? How could it be possible that when I am faced with Jesus and I sing about Jesus and I read about Jesus, that I am actually faced with Yahweh, the Almighty, hidden but seen? Now, I don't know about you, but you got a tougher faith, or else you just blank out the impossibility sometimes in the Bible. But I sometimes find that's impossible. How could that be so? So that's why I say, you either trust it or you forget it. So ponder. What have I got there, Daniel? I don't know where you got that from. That's good. I think we've been through that. All right, Logos. We move on. We move on again. We're doing jumps here this morning. But I'm just wanting to pick up on some of our inheritance and what it might mean for us today. So we come to the Reformation, would you believe? And the Reformation is Luther's big moment, and Calvin's and others, Zwingli. But let's just focus a little bit more. Luther was, as you know, a Catholic monk, teacher, priest. And as the story goes, he went to visit Rome as a pilgrim, and he was crawling up the steps of St. Paul's Cathedral. What was the cathedral in Rome? Whatever, whichever one it was, St. Peter's, St. Paul's, I get mixed up. And apparently you crawled up these steps on your knees, and each step was in a sort of a penitence form of adoration and penitence and all that. But as he went up these steps, a recurring phrase came to him that he'd read in the scriptures: the just shall live by faith. Up a step. The just shall live by faith. And Luther got converted then, not in the way that we talk about it in our evangelical circles. He realized something that he'd never seen before in the scriptures. That it wasn't the formalities and traditions and idiosyncrasies and even the bizarre in the Roman church of his day. It was God saying, faith is what you need. Faith is all you need. And so he attacked the Roman church by putting up 95 questions and saying, what do you think about this? This is what a scholar would do. And he would ask for a scholarly opinion about his questions. And this went on from one to another, and as you know, it became the Reformation. The Roman church could not handle this, but the rest of the many in the European circle took it on board, and I guess, became Christians rather than going through the formalities of the Roman system. But I put up six things there. I don't know whether Daniel's got them up. Keep going, Daniel. Way behind. Man alive, there we are. Six. These are the six things I pointed out that have come from the Reformation, which are our inheritance. The Bible was translated and distributed. That had never happened before. Only certain people in the church could have a Bible, and no one in the Roman Catholic Church was encouraged to read it, and most couldn't read anyway. Secondly, there was a freedom that came like a breath of fresh air across the European theatre, that all Christians could approach God without a priest. Today we call it the priesthood of all believers. Thirdly, this movement of Luther's eroded the power of Rome and all the clerical power and privilege that went with it. You see, the people were totally subservient to what the priests asked of them and told them. There was no way you could disagree with them. No way you could deny that they were right or wrong because you didn't know. They were in absolute ignorance and therefore lived by superstition. Fourthly, Luther opened schools left, right, and center because he believed in education. He believed that people should learn to read and read the Bible. And so this exploded across Europe. Five, women were liberated from nunneries and convents. Luther was married himself. Now, why was that important? Well, if you didn't know what to do with your daughter and you had one, you'd send them to a convent or a nunnery if they weren't married or if they had sinned. Whatever, any excuse. So they went there without whether they liked it or not. So there were jails, basically, for women. And Luther broke the bars apart. And then sixth, it was the beginning of reason instead of superstition and dogmatism. And it was based upon that the Enlightenment happened in Europe and changed the world. Those six things are our inheritance. You might never have thought of it this way, but if you look at that and think, what if we didn't have that? Where would you be? Where would we be? That's our whakapapa. Along with this, and this is something I want you to ponder. I don't know what I've got up there. What's the next one? Yeah, that. I want you to ponder that. This is the rock from which you are hewn. We are sitting here in our nice church chapel, in a nice friendly atmosphere, a nice, peaceful country. But I want us never to forget that we are here because of that. Rome hated anybody that disagreed with her. And they persecuted Christians, high up hill and down dale for centuries. They persecuted anyone that didn't agree with them. They started with the Crusades, sent people off to kill the Muslims. They killed probably as many Christians and Jews as they did the Muslims. The Spanish Inquisition tracked down anybody that had any inkling as to some difference they called heresy. Surprising, you know, when you think about it, and I cannot enter into this either, as I read the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, I just cannot enter into it, how a refugee feels. Because the Old Testament is full of refugee stories. It was a norm. I can't enter into it. I can read about it. I can mentally see it. And oh, yeah, so the Syrians took them and the Babylonians took them and the Egyptians took them and the Romans took them and the Greeks took them. And this doesn't touch my heart. But this is our heritage, folks. We might not feel it. We might not ever see it. But if it wasn't for Christians who were faithful to the gospel and got hunted and reviled and tortured and killed, we wouldn't be here today, I guess. And finally, and quickly, because it's 11 o'clock and you're wanting your morning tea, I cannot leave our Christian whakapapa without talking about the brethren. Now, this is a quasi-brethren church. All right, it's not what it used to be, not what it was when the brethren started. So we have, oh yeah, look at him. Who'd ever want to meet him in the dark? John Nelson Darby was a key figure in the beginning of what is called the Brethren movement back in the 1800s, 1830s. He was an Anglo-Irish priest, and he, in reading the scriptures, he realized that this is not what he should be doing. So he started to promote small groups. And became then small congregations. He was a very forceful man, very well educated. He knew, obviously, English. He knew Irish. maybe Gaelic, I don't know, possibly. He knew Dutch, German, and French. And in fact, he translated the whole of the Bible into Dutch, German, and French as well. He was a Hebrew scholar and he was a Greek scholar. So he was not a lightweight Christian by any stretch of the imagination. And once he got this conviction that the trappings of the organized church was not what he wanted, was not biblical, and what they taught was not true to the gospel, and what they didn't teach was also important to know, that he started these small groups with others. Didn't take long. Moved into England and set up chapels there in England. And then he toured around America and he toured around Europe. He was a very busy man, a very influential man. That's why John Nelson Darby is seen as probably the most important propagator of the Brethren movement in the world. One of the friends that he had a lot of influence with in America was another guy called Schofield. And Schofield was also a good Bible scholar. And Schofield took Darby's ideas and did, I think, what probably had never been done in the world before. He put a commentary in the Bible. And at the bottom of each page, there was a commentary on what Schofield thought and what Darby taught him and so on. It became a commentary in its own self. Now, this is a Scofield reference Bible. And this was my father-in-law's. And if you wanted to know what a good old brethren elder did with his Bible, he would just absolutely mark it to the nth degree. By the way, this is a loose leaf Scofield Bible. I bought one too. So you can take out all the pages. And so if you didn't like a chapter, you'd take it out and rip it away, which was a great idea. I don't think Scofield liked that idea, but that's what I did. I took out the whole of the Scofield Bible, threw it away, and put in a Good News Bible. So if you see me with the black Bible, it's a Scofield loose leaf binding, but a Good News Bible inside. So I just brought along as Exhibit A. This Bible spread like wildfire across America. It was an absolute bestseller. People couldn't get enough of it. And therefore, that set the doctrines of the evangelical church in America for the next 150 years and still today, the Scofield Bible and its references and its doctrinal position is serious stuff in the Southern Baptist churches of America. And so I conclude. Today, the International Brethren Conference on Missions Network gave a census figure, 40,000 congregations around the world, 2,700,000 members in 155 countries. So that, for some of you, and for others, you're just wondering, what on earth are you talking about, Renner? That is also our whakapapa. Let me close in a little prayer. Almighty God, you rescued from the waters and delivered from the fire. Too often, though, I fail to make the connection between what you have done in the glorious past and what you wish to do in me right now. Help me to make the connection through the hours of this day and each day. Amen. Thank you, Alex.